A quick Google search of 80s fashion trends shows that a lot of images of people in neon colors with crazy patterns, leg warmers, and windbreakers. These styles were basically non-existent in campus yearbooks. So why do you think that is? Like the contrast?
Well, because they would have been inappropriate to wear on campus.
Just due to the loudness of the items.
So a lot of it depends. So something in the 80s was very interesting is that in order to understand fashion in the 80s, you really have to look at what was happening in the government, right? And so it was Reagan in the White House, rebuilding America, some of the same discussion we're hearing now, that under the administration of the Carters and the Democrats, that America had gotten lost its way, was not being seen as important, and somehow this new administration was going to bring in the better America, the bigger America. And so everything sociologically was geared towards that. And so part of what you saw just in terms of the vibrancy of colors in some clothes of young people had to do with the social okay to be loud and to be bold. It still had to conform within the rules of the ideology of the controlling majority at the time, but that was part of it. Also, too, really important in understanding fashion of the 80s was the video Let's Get Physical by Olivia Newton-John. I actually watched the first day of MTV. Not because I cared at all about music videos, but what was this? And one of the first early videos was Let's Get Physical, and that revolutionized clothing. In addition to that, the workout video series that Jane Fonda did brought gym clothes out of the gym. And so part of to your question, part of what you were seeing is young people responding to the acceptedness of wearing gym clothes for a purpose other than that which they were invented as public statement and fashion.
Would you say that's the same is true too for lingerie and Madonna?
It's exactly the same.
Was that the first time you see it
too? Yeah. Well, yes. I mean, in the sense that you also can't talk about fashion without talking about Madonna and particularly her stylists and her designers, the most important of whom was Jean-Paul Gaultier, who was a very, very avant-garde designer. And so Madonna, as a social, as a fashion icon in the 80s, she's the Lady Gaga of then, or I actually like to think Lady Gaga is the her of, you know, now. But Madonna very consciously made choices to push boundaries relative to gender and to sex and to establish norms. So I don't know that it was Madonna per se, but it was Jean-Paul Gaultier who did that first bustier dress, the bustier that she wore as a way of shocking people. And then the whole desperately seeking Susan look, which was wearing bras and petticoats and things. So it is all tied together, but it's within the cultural context of the end of the Carter administration when, you know, we had the gas embargoes. I mean, I remember those. And then we had the hostage crisis in Iran, and he generally being seen, rightly or wrongly, as a completely inept president, and Reagan being able to come in, and part of his attraction was, I will make you great again, we will be strong again, we will be valued again. So it empowered people to buy into that, whether it was real or not is a completely different discussion. But you saw that manifested in freedom of clothing. And ironically, because it's also the same time we have the AIDS epidemic. So there wasn't a huge shift in morals in the majority ideology. But something about his voice coming in empowered minority voices to get the perception that they had a certain kind of freedom, which they really didn't have socially.
All right, so then... So assuming that, assuming that the fashion displayed in the yearbooks is more in line with what people actually wore in the 80s, why do you think the Google search trends are what we historically associate with the 80s, especially like when you see costumes of the 80s and people are like, oh, I'm going to dress up as someone from the 80s. And it's just like,
well, I think so part of that is, so the first part of your question was, to kind of clarify that, the yearbook of Mary Washington looks probably different than, say, the yearbook of a historically black college at the same time, or a college in the rural Midwest where I went to school. Because a lot of fashion, as you're learning, a lot of fashion is determined by lots of different things. But if you will, even through the 80s, there was more of a college uniform for genders. There were less options than there are for your contemporary classmates now. So that's the first thing, that there is a kind of uniform. For example, when I started teaching, when I went to graduate school in 90, my grandmother, who had gotten her master's degree in education in the 1930s, which was a big deal for a woman in Minnesota, and actually was getting a PhD, the first thing she did was take me out and buy me a sports coat, because she still thought in the 90s that men would have worn coats and ties to class and women dresses, because that's what she would have done. So there's always a kind of cultural uniform that's acceptable at colleges, but it certainly shifts. In terms of how we perceive the 80s, you know, that we have to remember the thing about Google is it's not real, it's popular. Because if you have a bunch, I would offer that if you have a bunch of scholars looking for images of fashion in the 80s, they're going to look for a completely different set of images than or will choose from Google the images that are different, mm-hmm. right? So it gets a little bit muddled when you move there, because particularly a younger, as a general rule, people looking back at fashion tend to fetishize what they're searching for. So if a contemporary student wants to say, well, I want to dress like the 80s, they're going to choose and select what they choose from the 80s. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So that if Google is then about rankings of which is more popular, they're going to be kind of iconographic images of any period, the flappers dressed of the 1920s, the corset of the Edwardian period, right? Which, as we're learning in class, are representative, but only slightly. And then remember I showed you, we looked at the pictures of the real people, mm-hmm. right? And so I suspect there's something to do with that. The reason that you get images when you do a basic Google search that are different, you say costume or fashion of the 80s, is because the people that are looking at it all have different agendas for what they want to do with it, right? Does that make sense?
Yeah, and I think in this case, a lot of people are looking for what's loud and shocking, right. Which would be right. those neon right. and the like numbers right. and everything.
Yeah, they're going into it with a preconceived idea. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, if I wanted to see what people wore in the 80s, I would do something like go to a yearbook first, mm-hmm. or I would go to the JCPenney's catalog, yeah. right? A more neutral source mm-hmm. than someone who's already crafted themselves. You know, and then the issue is, are the images they're finding actual human beings? Are they actors who've already then been dressed by a designer? Are they film stars? So that's one of the reasons in class that I show every once in a while the actual photos, so we can see what people really looked like. But even still, when you're dressing for a photograph, you're dressing in a way you don't usually dress.
Yeah, especially if it's a planned photograph. I mean, now we have all the photographs.
But that's not even true, because yeah. you know as well as you do, when you take a selfie, you don't just usually snap a selfie.
Well, yeah.
You fix your hair. So there's a really fabulous book that came out several years ago called Dressing for the Photographer. And it is a collection of essentially portraits from the invention of the camera through like the 1960s. And the idea being that how did people craft themselves for a photograph when it recorded you? And so there's absolutely no difference in taking a selfie. If anything, selfies are much more false, because you work very hard in that 1 second to craft what you want to be, you know, what you want to look like.
Yeah.
So.
All right. And then what cultural factors do you think influence the way people dress in the 80s? So you did say some about the presidency.
I mean, I think you cannot remove fashion from social, political, gender, socioeconomic rules. And I think that most historians would argue you cannot talk about anything related to social issues in the 80s without a discussion of the Reagan administration and how it control the narrative. And I don't mean that to sound as heavy-handed as it might. But in the same way that the Trump administration, any administration, chooses its own narrative, right? And if you look at that as a student, if you go back after we're done talking and you look at those speeches, they're very much about setting us up as being we can be a better place. And so fashion is going to do that, and it's going to give people the chance to do that. I think you cannot in the 80s underestimate the value of MTV in creating, certainly for a younger generation, because it isn't Madonna. I mean, look, something like a Duran Duran. If you look at the way Duran Duran dressed, if you look at the way Eddie Ant dressed, Pat Benatar, all of those people had an effect. And it's really when what is today known as the stylist becomes a very important gig. It's someone who's not even necessarily a designer, but they tell people what to wear and what is their style. And Madonna, you know, the best way is to look at the progression of Madonna. She changes her style several different times during the 80s to continue to remain relevant. Because if she is pushing her audience to follow her the way she's dressing, then she is relevant in their world and they will listen to her music. They will buy her music. She doesn't have to do that anymore. She's had her career. She's had her success. And you have Lady Gaga. And before that, you had Britney Spears, right? And before that, you had Cher, right? So I think media has something to do with it. Television and film, particularly films like the whole Brat Pack genre, which is the Molly Ringwald, the Breakfast Club things. I mean, those kids came to school dressed like they had just walked out of one of those teen movies, right? Mm-hmm. Television shows like The Cosbys, right? And so media continued to play importance. And then films like The Blade Runner, right? So, and also too important in this is under Reagan, this notion that we had wealth, we would buy things. So I wouldn't be surprised if you look at kind of the increasing credit that people would spend on clothing bought on credit, the continued merchandising of clothing, that you could buy what you could buy, what you could afford. So, you know, a designer label start to increase. That's the other thing too. The 80s really becomes the era with Calvin Klein and the Brooke Shields "Nothing Comes Between Me and My Calvins" ad. That becomes the idea of the celebrity designer, where the designer is more important than the clothing, right? So it is a period of excess. You know, in a lot of ways, we were just talking, we'll talk later in class about the Edwardian period, which is an exquisitely beautiful period about the excess, right? About excess. And you will read an article about the titled families in Manhattan spending phenomenal amounts on clothing. It was a period of excess. And I think most people don't look at that and go, the 80s, I think his social historians will tell you, was exactly the same thing. If you had credit, you could get whatever you wanted, right? And it became very important for people's identity to be attached to, you know, to Calvin Klein jeans or Ralph Lauren jeans, right? Or to have a specific kind of car, more so than it had ever been before. So if you go back and read Veblen's theory of conspicuous consumption, there really is no clearer manifestation of it in the 20th century than the 80s, the 1980s, because we know they were false, because then we hit a big recession, and that was, you know, so I think I've answered your question, but I think that's part of it. That's really part of it.
Yeah, I love that you're bringing up MTV, because that's one of the main things that we're focusing on, is just like MTV and pop culture. That's obviously really important for people in college. I mean, even today.
Right. Well, and it always, I mean, if you look at historically, right, I mean, so this campus would have gone through the Beatles. Mm-hmm. You know, and when we get to that in class, we'll talk about it. And the clothing that those four or five men wear directly affects. But it's counter clothing. Mm-hmm. It's stuff that your parents would have found vulgar and offensive, right? And so MTV did the same thing. It let young people see an alternative to what the establishment was wearing, you know. And then you could see the uniforms. You could see the kids that followed Duran Duran. You could see the kids that followed Madonna, right? Also, too, I think it's fair to say that there was a little of Miami Vice was a terribly important show in fashion, particularly for menswear, which really allowed menswear to be more traditionally feminine and softer linens, softer color palette. But yet the two men that were wearing it on the show, there was no question about their gender identity. Right, because that's the other thing about '80s. One has to think about clothing. There's still very, 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 very rigid gender lines. You know, so you had at the same time on TV, you had the kind of sensualness of these really macho detectives on Miami Vice, but then you had the same thing in the A-Team, which was completely different. Right, and then you have those wonderful shows like Dynasty and Dallas, mm-hmm. which were just opulence for opulence' sake, you know. And so it is. I think your generation very rightly looks at it and kind of fetishizes it, but if you really dig your head into it, it's a very interesting time that needs more study than we give it, because it was a pretty. There was something about the paradigm that changed, I think, in the '80s, right. And now it's fetishized so much as being such a great time, unless you were gay, or black, or Latin, or a woman, or poor, right? You know, and like I think that's the record, right? But clothing allowed you to kind of fuddle with that. You know, you could forget that you were kind of middle class white kid, and dress really hip, you know. And MTV gave you that voice. My parents kind of, they just didn't know what it was about. I didn't necessarily follow music, but you know, there's lots of scholars who've written on the connection between music and fashion, principally as movements of art affect one another.
Mm-hmm. Then, do you think that some of these factors or some of these, icons, appeal to certain groups of people more than others in regards to gender identity or sexual identity?
Always. Yeah. So, I mean, I think, you know, in a lot of ways, I'll say this again, in a lot of ways, Madonna is a terribly underappreciated figure for the freedom she gave people. You need only look at the growth of the gay culture while Madonna was an icon. So, you know, there were different labels then, right? But Madonna was very part of the gift, part of the, I'm going to say gift because I think it was, part of the gift that she gave to gay men was she was their outlet. I mean, I'm not a big club person, but I didn't go to very many clubs in the '80s. I went a little bit later, but right, there wasn't a drag show that didn't have Madonna in it. And part of it is because she was thumbing her nose at society. And she embraced gay and lesbian people. And so they felt a certain kind of empowerment through her, right? So that allowed a marginalized people to feel like they had representation and they had a voice in the discourse. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Right? And so I think that there are several of those what today we would call icons, who historically have always carried a much larger statement than they either wanted to or chose to. What else was the question? I feel like I forgot to answer something.
Some of these factors or icons appeal to certain groups of people more than others. But you pretty much answered that.
Yeah, so. I mean, I think Madonna was very threatening to the establishment. Mm-hmm. I mean, she wore a bra outside of her dress. Yeah. Today that is so passé. But that was pretty rude. That was pretty vulgar, right? In the same way that, you know, when Britney Spears, 10 or 15 years later, wore that really, really flesh-colored suit and was, you know, and bumping and grinding. Mm-hmm. And so I think Madonna, as often happens, both certainly in music, but like the Beatles, she threatened the status quo. And the problem was you couldn't write her off. You know, she may have ended up being a dreadful actress, but you couldn't top her music you just couldn't, right? And so she threatened everybody because she had a bloody good talent. She had a huge following. She was making gobs of money for the powers that be. And she had a voice, and she used that voice, right? And so then it did empower little queer kids, right? Heterosexual kids who just wanted to be different, you know? I mean, I remember, you know, going like, not so much, probably not so much in Fredericksburg, Virginia. But I bet if you went to Washington, D.C. in this, like if you were a student in Fredericksburg, Virginia, and you were going to go to a club in D.C., you know, you probably didn't dress like Madonna on this campus very much. But when you and your friends went to D.C. to go to a club or to Richmond, I bet you saw a lot more Madonnas there, right? Gay men on this campus. There probably wasn't a lot of voguing on this campus, although it comes later in her career. But I know for been in the clubs there were. So definitely there are icons. There are icons of any period that affect other people, right? But in the 80s, we have television, right? We have the television media. You know, at the end of it, we kind of get the computer, right? But she certainly, as one of them, I'm trying to think who else would have been an important icon.
Probably Prince.
Certainly Prince.
Do people look up to him as a source of empowerment?
You know, Prince, and from my mind, Prince would be interesting because
he was feminine, but he was still.
He had a very, very feminine. I'm sure he was very frightening to people because he projected a certain kind of femininity in a way that wasn't. But he was breathtakingly handsome. Mm-hmm. But he also had the talent to back it up, right? Michael Jackson, you know, before, you know, he's hard to talk about, right? But before he kind of stepped so far away from a sense of normalcy, I think, he was terribly empowering, you know, to not only people of color, but any kid that was an artist, any kid that was a geeky kid who wanted to sing or dance or act, he was the validation of it, right? And so MTV allowed those things to happen. And then you bring into it fashion, right? In his white glove, right? The hat pulled down over the eyes, you know? The Thriller video, which was terribly influential and stuff, you know? So certainly there were those icons too. And there, you know, there were kind of, you still had a more established genre of older kind of music stars. But I think in terms of influencing young people in their fashion, it is kind of the equivalency of the Beatles for the generation prior to that, where they would have seen them on television and the Ed Sullivan Show, right? This was a whole new way for students to continually, you know, and then the whole kind of the subculture, the kind of punk rock, right, that really comes to us kind of from a British point of view. Because there was that whole other, even scarier side to people, which was the safety pins and the piercings and the torn jeans, you know. So the ironic thing I always think is that the 80s, I still think, was very much about, at least in the United States, a fairly rigid social structure that really wasn't very permeable. But what MTV did consciously or subconsciously is it allowed a lot of different alternatives to be seen. And people started to get a sense of, I'm not the only one. And so when somebody dressed like Madonna or somebody dressed in true punk, which is not what you go buy at, you know, Hot Topic in the mall, right? For people who were any kind of other, whether it was a gender other, an intellectual other, it gave you, you know, I tell students often, imagine if you were born with blue hair and you never saw anyone with blue hair. No matter how much people tell you're okay, you're still the only one with blue hair. And imagine one day you turn on the TV and there's another blue-haired person. Or you go to school and there's another blue-haired person. And in that one second, your life completely changes. So you see Madonna and you see the B-52s and you see Duran Duran. Those guys were so sexy. Duran Duran were so... In what today we would call the metrosexual sense, they were so sexy, right? But they weren't necessarily offensive, you know, in their self, you know. And so others started to see others, you know. And so I think it's part of the reason we're here. Certainly we're here today, and certainly in the queer world. But if whatever identifying label a person wants there, you started to see yourself. Either covertly or subtly. And so, as I said earlier and keep saying, I just think one of the great dichotomies of the 80s is this very kind of rigid social structure and hierarchy, and money is good, and American values are good, and middle class values and what we should thrive on. This is family, this is family. But the students, young people, were getting to see lots of different variations of that that started to call into question. Well, yes, I know we're saying that, you know, the nuclear family is preferred in all of this, but, you know, here's some people with differences that seem to be perfectly fine and happy and dress funny and have good lives. And so I think you can't underestimate that. And fashion then did that. Fashion allowed you to, but at the same time, always remember that fashion is an industry. So when so-and-so realized Madonna could wear underwear outside of her clothes, they'll start producing underwear.
All business.
It is. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, at one point, it is all business.
Yeah.
Right? You know, and sometimes it moves for the better and sometimes for not. But, you know, but once they think, once a fashion house can make money on it, then, you know, which is then why Madonna would change her look so often, because it had become passé. And in order for her to keep her relevance as a cultural icon, she had to change it, and she drove it. She drove. A certain demographics look for all of the 80s, which is a pretty awesome legacy to have left, I think. And she wasn't a first lady.
Yeah, she's, I don't know, I can't say anything other than an icon.
Yeah.
Okay, so in the 60s and 70s, there was a lot of, I guess, androgynous fashion was starting to come at a height, but then it was kind of pushed down in the 80s.
So I would argue that's kind of a misnomer. So the issue here is to determine what actually androgyny in fashion means. So I think you're right. I think there is a perception that in the 60s and 70s there was androgynous fashion, but pretty much all of the fashion that I teach and know of was completely gendered. So I think what happens is there are some iconic images from the 60s and 70s of models or people who appear to be androgynous. But there really wasn't. So I think that's a misunderstanding of the period. Because if you really, really objectively sit back and look at the fashion of the 60s and 70s, it's very gendered. What you got was some of the counterculture of the 60s and 70s wanting to make commentary, right? And so you had designers like Rudy Greenwich, who was doing bathing suits that were for male or female, right? And you had models like Twiggy. But part of that was just a different aesthetic. So I think if you really objectively look at the period, I mean, women dressed like Jackie Kennedy, that was the style, right? And men like her husband, that was there. So there really wasn't a non-gender. Now, the only exception there might be things like denim and white T-shirts.
So would you say then that the 80s is kind of the height? Because that's what I thought of androgynous fashion. Because there's icons like Grace Jones, and I guess you could argue Prince as well.
I don't think so. So here's the thing, right? So the issue with androgyny relative to fashion is it's about semantics. You have to define what androgyny means, right? And so we always have this discussion with students. I want to write an androgyny in fashion. It's very hard to do androgynous fashion because you're dressing a gendered body. You're dressing a body that has a certain shape to it, which establishes a biological gender, right? And we understand gender as a larger construct. So we talk about this thing called androgyny, but I don't think there's ever been androgynous fashion. Because to truly be androgynous, it would have to remove any sense of gender underneath it. And usually androgynous fashion is a woman in a suit, and maybe she's wearing a translucent shirt. Well, we see her breasts, so we've gendered it already. Now, someone like Grace Jones, if you really look at Grace Jones, though, there was nothing androgynous about it. It was very clear she was a woman. Mm-hmm. Right? It was very, very clear right? So it all depends on how you define androgyny. If androgyny means removing gender from clothing, then t-shirt and jeans is about as androgynous as you can get, right?
So then would you say that instead of calling or saying that it's androgynous fashion, it's just fashion that adopts the styles previously associated with the opposite gender?
Well, what I think I might say, it's non-gendered.
Okay.
Right? A dress is gendered. Mm-hmm. Jeans are not. A t-shirt is not. Right? But a dress, as in its construction, is gendered.
But could jeans be gendered because they have different cuts? Like,
Of course they could. Right? So that's why I said, so the concept of androgyny, like, I can't think of a silhouette that's androgynous mm-hmm. in like all of fashion that I know of, you know?
Yeah, because even blazers.
Because, right, as soon as you put it on a body, the body is in fact gendered. Mm-hmm. So that's why I say, I think it's a fair, the question of androgyny in clothing is fairly complicated. We want there to be androgyny in clothing because we think somehow it might help us. But the challenge is it goes over a gendered body, mm-hmm. right? And so I think, to go back where we started, I think there was the perception that there were androgynous people like Grace Jones. But I don't think she really was. If you looked at all of her visual representations, it's very clear that she's a woman. Yeah. And Prince was not trying to be androgynous. Mm-hmm. Prince was just trying to be who he was as a performer, right? Because the way he dressed was very masculine. You know, in a certain style, a certain kind of club way. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah. I mean, I didn't consider him, but I was doing research online, and they were like, Prince, and I was like,
right. I would argue he was not androgynous.
Yeah.
Because he always looked like a boy. He always mm-hmm. looked like a gendered man.
Yeah.
Now, he may have worn purple and earrings, you know, so the question is, what really makes someone androgynous? Mm-hmm. Right? And the thing about clothing is, it generally doesn't have gender until it's put on a body and conforms to that shape.
That makes sense.
A t-shirt hanging on a hanger is truly androgynous. But as soon as you put it on, because you have breasts and I do not, that adds a certain gender to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Without hopefully not seeming crass or vulgar.
Yeah, that makes sense. I was thinking the same thing, like with skirts, because today, you know, androgynous fashion, a lot of men wearing skirts.
But they don't call them skirts. They call them kilts.
Yeah.
I will bet you dinner for a week that if you ask a man, is that a skirt? No, it's my kilt.
Yeah.
Right? Even though it's exactly... So that, you know, that's how gender can be attached to clothing, right? Mm-hmm. Because clothing is part of the social construct that we use to define gender. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Maybe. The only time clothing can truly be androgynous is on a baby.
Yeah.
When you can't determine a biological gender yet, you put them in, which is why we put them in blue and pink, mm-hmm. right? So that's probably, in my mind, the only time you could actually get away with androgyny clothing, because there's nothing else to indicate gender biologically.
Mm-hmm. Makes sense.
Right?
Yeah. So that answered my second question. And third. Do you know of any other cultural factors that challenged the binary of gender in the 80s? Fashion-related or non-fashion-related, yes. Of course we have
the challenge, the binary nature of gender.
Yeah.
I think to in a sense, not necessarily fashion, but I think to in a sense AIDS did. Mm-hmm. If only because it brought it in the public discourse and people had to wrap their head around, well, what are they talking about? What is gay? What is lesbian? What is bisexual, right? And in a way that's very not as advanced as we are today. And it didn't necessarily have anything to do with fashion, you know. Well, and it did in the sense that someone like Rock Hudson was people couldn't believe that Rock Hudson had AIDS because he looked so male. Right? So what you can't see as I'm listening here is I'm shrugging my arms, right? Like, so he can't possibly be gay because he looks like a man, right? So I think in that way, that started to call into question, well, what is gender, right? What is that stuff? But I can't think of anything. I can't think of anything else that hits my head right away. Like, what would, you know, and on a college campus.
Nothing like how we have feminist T-shirts are a big trend right now. Nothing like that.
No, because the kind of T-shirt like that is roughly a late 80s, early 90s invention. Mm-hmm. If anything, what it was is it would be appropriating clothing. So a man wearing a shirt, like a gay man wearing a shirt, but like tying it up around his stomach, like if you think a la Marianne and Gilligan's Island, mm-hmm. right? So it would be appropriating or. You know, the kind of joke, a tasteless joke, right? That lesbians wear flannel shirts. Because the flannel shirt was traditionally a male garment, and when a woman puts it on, all of a sudden, well, why are you wearing that? That's not a male garment. But it is still today culturally acceptable for a woman to culturally appropriate a man's silhouette, but not the other way around. Right? So a woman can dress like a man, and still we can still contact her and figure out. But a man, even in college, puts on a dress. Even in our enlightened day, there's still going to be lots of people that probably, why is that boy wearing a dress? Mm-hmm. Right? So there certainly was that. There certainly were appropriation of other gendered clothing crossing the lines, right? Or, you know, lesbian women who would dress in a white t-shirt and blue jeans, comb their hair back, and they may have had some biological indication of femininity, of traditional, that sounds so horrible. So then they cause some gender confusion because our first, well, you look like you have breasts, but you're dressed like a man. Mm-hmm. So I think in the 80s, that's probably what it was. It was the taking of clothing and challenging it, you know, horrific one, which is women having to wear, when women started to enter the workforce in greater numbers, wearing business suits crafted along the masculine line so they would be taken seriously.
Yeah, the shoulder pads.
Right, especially. The shoulder pads, mm-hmm. the square cut, yeah. And there was a whole movement of that. And that's definitely using clothing to say, because I'm a woman, I can be as good as a man. Like, as I say this, I find it offensive. Because I look like a man, I'm as good as a man, right? Because the reverse is never true. You know, think of a really powerful woman, and no man ever says, I want to be taken seriously, so I'll dress like Katharine Graham at the New York, you know. I mean, think about it, right? Katharine Graham at the Washington Post, mm-hmm. who ends up being one of the most important paper owners of the 20th century. Nobody says, I want to be powerful like Katharine Graham, so I'm going to dress like Katharine Graham. Right? Like, we would go, well, that's wrong, right? But the other is expected.
Yeah.
You know. So, you know, and we had, you know, again, we had in the White House, we had a really strong iconographic role. We had a very, 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 very exquisitely beautiful feminine first lady and a very masculine first man, right? So there was no question of gender roles, mm-hmm. right? So I know on college campuses you saw that. I remember being in college in the 80s and seeing that even in the University of South Dakota, boys particularly challenging gender norms by wearing a blouse that they got at Goodwill, because that's the other thing that can be kind of fascinating here, is the rise in secondhand clothing. Goodwill became really popular. So you could go, I remember a kid I went to college with who was very, very gay, but didn't know how to express it. So the first thing he did was he started to wear really short cutoffs, like we would call them Daisy Dukes today, and a blouse that he'd bought at Goodwill that was kind of manly, but tied up around the waist. And then his hair was platinum blonde a la Adam Ant. Right, and that was very much about trying to feel a sense of identity with how he was crafting himself using clothing, but still clothing that was appropriate within his cultural world.
Yeah, because it can be hard to isolate or to alienate yourself so much when
people. Well, because you don't want to alienate yourself to the point of yes, you feel free, but then you have no friends. Yeah. And what's the point of it?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.